Almost all of the more recent work on asymptotic safety has been done using the filter formalism, namely that of the functional renormalization group for the average active action. And most people think that the non-trivial fixed point that has been found using this formalism is due to specific non-perturbative features of this technique. What I would like to do in my talk today is to advance the unorthodox point of view. Nothing non-perturbative is going on here. So both the fixed point and the asymptotically safe coupling flow leading to it is well within the realm of standard one loop renormalized perturbation theory. Not with some, not in any way the renormalization improve. However, of course, some suitable modifications and adaptations is found in order to see this fixed point. So the plan of the talk is I will first spend some time spelling out which kind of modifications or adaptations need to be done in order to see the fixed point. And then I will basically skip all computational details and just show you the final results for one loop renormalizable Einstein-Hilbert theory, and it's all loop perturbatively renormalizable higher derivative modification. There's a kind of outlook. I'll offer you some remarks why this modified perturbation theory does what it does, and offer maybe also some remarks about the potential interplay with the functional renormalization group.
Sorry, could you put the microphone on?
Oh,
sure. Speak up.
I thought the best way to get started is give you a little puzzle. And the puzzle looks as follows. So one of the hallmarks of gravity theories is the fact that Newton's constant and cosmological constant are dimensionful. So this is what one does, and what is now standard is to change to dimensionless counterparts of these couplings by rescaling with an appropriate power of the renormalization scale. But these couplings still know about the fact that they come from dimension full couplings, and they know about this fact through an enhanced sensitivity to finite coupling definitions. So on a one loop level, the appropriate coupling redefinitions are of this form, and if one looks what the beta functions look like after the coupling redefinition, then one sees that they transform in a non-trivial way, which is of course very different from the way a normal beta function of a dimensionless coupling would transform, namely would simply be mapped map onto itself. So this is one of the hallmark features of the Newton and the cosmological constant. And it makes one wonder, do these beta functions contain any intrinsic information? And let me mention, although I spell this now out on a one loop level, I could of course perform similar coupling redefinitions on whatever non-perturbative formalism you use, and the same issue would be there. So do these beta functions of G and lambda actually contain non-trivial intrinsic information? And the answer I would like to propose is yes, but in order to be able to spin down this piece of information, a number of modifications compared to the standard perturbative framework need to be done. So first, what one should do is to work with a regulator that keeps track of power-like divergences in the ultraviolet cutoff. As well. This is in fact only natural, since one has at least two couplings which scale naturally power-like. So one should use such a regulator. Then it turns out that a non-minimal subtraction ansatz for kappa squared and lambda is needed. And then a kind of Wilsonian matching condition will be used, to which I will come later. And a point which are already raised is the gauge is the fact that of course one would want to design the background effective action in such a way that when the background satisfies the classical field equation, the background effective action becomes independent of the chosen match condition. Now, this is a feature which is always satisfied for the coefficients of the logarithmic divergences. However, it is not satisfied by any other parts of the background effective action, unless one does something very special. And I will also mention what one needs to do. So the plan now for much of the talk will be develop this modified perturbative framework, and then to try to one loop the normalizable Einstein-Hilbert theory and its all loop renormalizable higher derivative modification. So let me start with the regulator. I think on the one loop level, the method of choice are heat kernels techniques. So it's natural also to use a regulator that makes use of the heat kernel. And so let A be a symmetric covariant differential operator of even order, and this little a, or non-boldface A, the associated heat kernel. Then one picks a regulator function which depends on an infrared cutoff and an ultraviolet cutoff, such that the renormalization scale is sandwiched between the two. In the end, it turns out that only certain moments of the inverse Laplace transform of this regulator function will enter, which I denote here by squ n. And then the basic regularization prescription is to replace the log of A by an integral operator, which whose kernel is given by a smeared out version of the heat kernel. And as you can see, the normalization of this inverse Pascal form is such that if you were to formally pull the limit into 0 or 1 terms to infinity under the integral, you would formally get back the law. And this is designed in a way so that it gives rise to unique expressions for the regularized inverse, the regularized determinant, and also for Gaussian integrals with this kernel A here. Now inserts the small T expansion of the heat kernel and sort of picks up the large lambda asymptotic of the log of the depth of A. So as you can see, it starts off with cutoff to the power 4, cutoff squared, and the usual log term, where here these moments of the regulator function enter, and E0, E2, E4 are the heat kernel coefficients of A. And what one gets then for the form of the divergent part of the one loop effective action is an expression like that. So there is the familiar logarithmic divergent part, and there are pieces which diverge like powers of the ultraviolet cutoff.
And where did you get the Y3? Zeta 4, Zeta 5 terms.
Well, I left it out because I left out the Euler term, because I'm working in strictly four dimensions. This would be topological space, topological term, but so to say, I left space here for later Zeta 3. That's why this.
They shouldn't be these terms. I don't see how they can be.
No. As I say,
how did you get those?
My question is, what is Y3 zeta 4?
So these are simply the to be found coefficients. Now that's what my aim is. Just as in the normal quantum theory computation, what one normally works out, say, are the coefficients of the logarithmically divergent terms of the effective action.
I guess I missed, what's the definition of mu? You introduced the infrared
cutoff. It's the sliding renormalization scale. So the, maybe I should go back one. So one has this regulator function F here, which depends on an infrared cutoff and an ultraviolet cutoff, such that the sliding renormalization scale is sandwiched between the two. That's.
So there should be some normalization conditions where.
I'm not yet there. But what we'll get, of course, even if you hadn't this heat kernel expansion, then it's clear that it's purely dimensional bounds, the divergent part of the effective action must be of that form.
This is starting from R minus 2G. This is starting from Einstein.
No. No matter what you do, because, yeah.
So if we consider flat space, R is equal to zero, C squared is equal to zero, what is mu? In flat space, you have, if you have masses in logarithm of box plus m squared, you don't have m squared. That's true. But if you don't have any masses, you'll not have any mu. Unless I'm misunderstanding.
Then maybe so this term. So if you're worried about that this form of the divergent part of the effective action, say, wouldn't work for a conventional phi to the fourth theory in flat space, it certainly also works. It's also that form. It's simply a special case.
My worry is about free theory.
I suggest we just continue at this
point. No, but this formula is not deep. So, the reason why I sort of spelled it out here, you can in a sense see now whatever sort of variant of the one loop determinants you have. It will give rise to a formula, let's say this epsilon one coefficient is determined by the E zero heat current coefficients. Epsilon two and epsilon three will be determined by the E two heat current coefficient, and the log term by the familiar E four. So, which is spelled out here. So, once one knows what the divergent part of the effective action looks like, one will do the usual thing, namely this divergent part will now be absorbed by both couplings and field renormalizations. The only non-standard feature is here that for kappa squared and this combination here, a non-minimal subtraction ansatz should be used. So this means that in addition to the familiar logarithmically divergent part, and of course now needs also these power line divergent pieces, but for later use I also do include a finite term here, A0 and B0. And then, as usual, if one stipulates that the divergent part of the effective action is cancelled by the counter term, this will fix here A1, A2, A3, B1, A1, B2 in terms of this numbers epsilon 1 through epsilon 3 and theta, so which were worked out before, where the A0 and the B0 are left unspecified. Now, it turns out to be useful to redefine A0 and B0, because if one now, if one then works out beta functions, which one gets from here only by stipulating, as usual, that the bare coupling do not depend on mu, then one gets beta functions which look like that. So what you can see that the freedom of specifying the non-minimal part in this subtraction scheme is exactly in one-to-one correspondence to the freedom of performing such finite coupling redefinitions. Yeah. So in the next step, so far, I only used, as one normally does, that the bare couplings are really independent. Now I want to make contact to a Wilsonian picture, which means I want to read the bare couplings as the running or renormalized couplings. at the UV scale, and then you're led to these two conditions. Why? Because in a Bernoullian picture, the idea is that you start at the UV scale and you do the functional integral in a piecemeal fashion. So at the UV scale, no modes have yet been integrated out. So the renormalized coupling should simply match the bare coupling at the UV scale. One can in fact also look at this matching condition from a different angle. So what is normally not yet done in these studies is to do what one would usually do in quantum field theory computation, namely to fix the finite parts of the effective action by imposing suitable renormalization conditions on the vertex functions. And of course, in quantum gravity, or let me first say, and one can on simple examples, like adding a vacuum energy term to a scalar field theory, one can indeed see that this matching condition sort of shortcuts the stipulation of normal renormalization conditions on the level of the vertex function. Now for phi to the fourth theory, the vertices are very simple, so it isn't much of a shortcut. However, as you may know, the higher order vertices for a gravity theory are very messy, so it's a formula shortcut to use this instead of normalization conditions. Now you can see, since B2, A2, and A3 are known, this also fixes B0 and B0. And if you insert here, you can see that you get a formula which fixes now C1 and D1. So even going back to the first page, you now see that there is one and only one choice of this function, which sort of gives these beta functions, which you would compute a natural Wilsonian interpretation. This is one way of looking at these conditions, or the other is, as I mentioned, as a shortcut for specifying conventional renormalization conditions. And either way, the C1 and D1 are now fixed. So that was third point. And then the last point here, one wants to aim at the background effective action, which is on shell gauge independent. Now there is an entire bag of formal arguments to the effect that this should always be the case, and these formal arguments do indeed bear out as far as the coefficients of the logarithmically divergent parts of the effective action is concerned. It fails for all other parts of the effective action. And if one sort of goes through the various versions of these formal arguments, one finds in the end that the main culprit for this failure is the fact that for regularized infinite dimensional determinants, this naive multiplicative property simply fails. And it's so let me stress this is not a feature of any particular regularization scheme like the one I'm using here. It's a mathematical fact that the only class of operators where the determinant exists as a basis independent notion, where this multiplicative property holds, are so-called stress class operators. And as a matter of fact, all of the differential operators which show up in a context like that are simply never ever stress class. So this multiplicative property will always fail. So what one has to do then if one wants to end up with a background effective action that is gauge independent on shell, one has to somehow choose a formulation which is already where the physical degrees of freedom are already visible to a certain extent. And this is, of course, the familiar transversal stressless decomposition of the metric calculations. Then one also has to take into account the sort of extra factor in addition to the Fadif Popper factor that comes from using the simple geometric measure on the space of metrics. And also should use as first advocated by Motula and Mazur, Hessian relative indefinite fiducial Bewitt metric. And then one has to think about how to choose the equivalent of such factors. But it turns out all this can be done and ends up with a one loop background factor action that is fully gauge independent on shell on a regularized line, all terms independent. So so far this sort of spells out the modifications or the adaptations of this one loop perturbative framework that one needs. And as I said, I will now simply skip all the computational details and simply give you the final answer. So the results for Einstein-Hilbert gravity are as follows. So there is indeed a non-trivial fixed point. The nice feature of the one for the cosmological constant is that it is manifestly gauge independent, and as you can see, only these moments of the cutoff function of the regulator function enters always positive numbers of order one. So this is manifestly gauge independent and always positive. For the non-trivial fixed point of the Newton constant, one finds that there is a residual gauge dependence, as is there for the full beta function. But in all the gauges, what we normally think of, non-trivial fixed point. The Newton constant is also robustly positive. And then one can look at the stability matrix, which turns out always have a complex conjugate pair of eigenvalues and the associated flow pattern for spiraling. And even if you have queries about the technique used, the picture certainly looks like the one which has been found before using the functional renormalization group. And I will, in the end, as I mentioned, offer some remarks why this is so. This is what one finds. And now the counterpart of these results for higher derivatives in gravity are even more interesting. So just as a brief reminder about the what's known about this theory, so the action looks as an indicator, and C square is the square of the wire tensor, R is the Ricci tensor, and S and omega are the mentioned less coupling constant. It has been known since a long time that this theory should be perturbatively renormalizable to all loop orders, and the basic feature which is responsible for this is a strong one of the features of what kind of momentum decay of the free property which we the log flows, so the parts of the beta functions which one gets by standard perturbative computation from the logarithmically divergent parts of the effective action have also been known for a long time, especially important is the fact that this running fucking S, so the inverse group factor of the wire tension square is in one loop of the definition theory already asymptotically free. The flow equation for the omega is also known. And this sign convention here is such that omega positive corresponds to the classical regime. That is, you find this positive omega, for example, the action gives rise to a well-defined U-carbon type modification of the standard force law. Now, non-trivial fact is that this stacking omega has a unique ultraviolet stable fixed point, which is negative. So along the way from the classical to the UV regime, this coupling will change sign. For the sort of big unitarity issue, which people sort of stopped from looking at this theory further, mostly arises from a combination of two factors. Namely, one tries to do perturbation theory in the dimension four coupling, kappa squared, and one tries to use the value of the coupling omega, which corresponds to the classical, semi-classical regime. And so this, in recent years, in fact, has sparked again some renewed activity where this unitarity issue has been studied in various scoring models, and various sets of authors claimed even this version of the puzzle the reason out. So one can still make sense out of, say, this Lundberg oscillator and so on. Now, if one uses this modified one loop formalism, actually things get much nicer. So one now finds manifestly gauge independent and always strictly positive fixed points for both the Newton constant and the dimensionless cosmological constant. In fact, the entire beta functions are now manifestly gauged. Gauge independent. The stability matrix has now two real eigenvalues, -2 and -4. And all sorts of what is left from sort of scheme dependence, if you wish, is the dependence on these moments of the regulator function. But by analogy to a lattice system, this is certainly also the best one can.
And if you have even apart from S, you have three coupling parameters. You have GN, lambda, and omega.
Right.
So why don't you give three? It also has a repulsive direction?
No. So what?
What happens with omega?
Right. So what happens is all in all, one has four.
Four with S.
S dot, omega dot, G dot, and lambda. And as a matter of fact, the two differential equations for S and omega decouple from the others. So that makes life much easier. One can solve these two differential equations easily in closed form. And for S, one has the decay. And for omega, one finds a rational dependence basically on a log mu scale, and that leads to this, to the fact that with whatever omega value one starts off at some finite normalization to mu zero, if there's for large mu, always go to this UV fixed point under the star, which is slightly negative, and then the.
Well, how does it go? I mean, what is the, when you're near omega star, what is the correction?
I think it's power like in log mu.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And now the G dot and the lambda dot depend on the, so the beta functions for G and lambda depend on and omega. But since these two differential equations decouple, I can simply insert the solution into these beta functions, and then I can solve and see what one gets at the next block, in fact, show what one gets. Maybe I can do this now. So what one gets is by then numerically integrating the remaining two differential equations. It is a picture like that. So this is me, and then one specifies, say, the initial data for lambda and G varies on order of order 10. And as you can see, the flow has the remarkable fact that the memory on the initial data is erased on a scale of only 5 to 10. Units in the normalization scheme. And after that, the lambda simply becomes functionally dependent of G. And then, so this is not shown to scale now, so after these blue lines merge, they're still sort of way off the fixed point value, and the remaining dynamics is then a very, very simple, namely this merge line that very, very slowly approaches the fixed point, so slowly that actually even at the mu equal to 10 to the 9, there are still order 1% deviations.
That doesn't sound consistent with the eigenvalues you get at the -2 and the -4. That, I mean, doesn't that mean that you should approach the fixed point like mu to the minus 2 and mu to, yeah, mu to the minus 4?
Yeah, no, this is so to say, I looked into that, and indeed, I think it is like that. What one can do to make one's life simpler is to feed into the right hand side of these beta functions, which are still functions of S and omega, the fixed point values simply. So put on the right hand side of these beta functions S equal to 0 and omega to a slightly negative fixed point value, then one gets a very simple system of differential equations which one can solve in closed form. And in that form, one can directly see the two, the minus 2 and the minus 4. So this funny behavior is entirely caused
by... because the, S and omega approach right, their fixed point right, very slowly.
Right, very slowly, exactly.
And until you are at the fixed point for S and omega, you don't have anything like this minus these exponents. Right. I see.
So let me go back here. I said that, and then I want to mention. So my view at least, the positivity issue, at least in the sense how it's usually formulated, is simply absent here. And it's sort of absent for the following reason. So if I look at the H fixed Hessian on that background, I can write down its spectral decomposition. So that means that we have an expression of this form, the I ones from 1 to 4. And these PI, so to say, age-dependent versions of the usual spin 2, spin 1, spin 2, projector, spin 0, and 2 pieces into which the spin one part decomposes, and this is such that all these four projectors are mutually orthogonal. This is not what is usually done. What is usually done is one takes a basis of 5 terms, where 4 of them are mutually orthogonal, but they are not. And not orthogonal to the fifth one. That has the advantage that the corresponding coefficient functions are polynomial in P, but of course in this form is not directly relevant to positivity of the spectrum. Positivity of the spectrum means these four lambdas should be positive, or stated differently, you want that Hessian or its inverse positive as a bilinear form, and this fact is basically in one correspondence to the fact that these spectral values are positive. And now, as I mentioned, so one feature one should take into account that one has this very nice dimensionless asymptotically freed coupling S. So it is natural to reorganize the perturbative series not as a series in kappa squared, but as a series in S. And then, so this thing will be of the form F say, some H0 plus a field, which is order S. But as you make the renormalization scale large, or you move to the ultraviolet, this piece gets tiny. And as a matter of fact, this part is strictly positive if you make mu large enough for all gauges, or at least all gauges I looked into. So and it's simply, so there are, I think, a number of reasons why this has not been found before. One reason is that one usually wanted to make contact to a particle picture, and then one had these five terms instead of the four terms, which are really strictly mutually orthogonal. But then in this five-term basis, the signs of the coefficients have no direct bearing on this kind of spectrum positivity. So that's what one finds. And as I said, I'd like to maybe devote the last part of the talk to making the attempt to spelling out, in my view at least, of the potential relation between this modified perturbation theory and the functional renormalization group. So at first sight, it seems using a perturbation theory in this context is anyhow a big step backwards. And then I'd say it is not, for the simple reason that the non-perturbative aspects of this flow equation formalism are really only skin deep, one must say. So a standard gauge fixing is used. The Grebov problem is not addressed. The naive measure of the metric fluctuations is used, and also the structure of the central object, namely the gamma k, beyond the local terms is really unknown, simply. Second point relates the role of the ultraviolet cutoff. So as we already learned yesterday, the standard way in which the functional renormalization group is used does not make use of any ultraviolet cutoff. It's simply not needed. And however, many people, including me, would want from the final, yet to be found, formalism, also see an answer where does the perturbative divergences enter, and how are they handled. And in this functional renormalization group, one can think of the ultraviolet cutoff entering as follows. So one should really think of this gamma k as also depending on an ultraviolet cutoff, which enters in a very specific way. Mm-hmm. By this is whatever dynamical principle you use to compute gamma and finite k and lambda, it will usually not come out in such a way that the regular lambda to infinity limit exists. Rather, what one has to do is to carefully fine tune the lambda dependence of the couplings, so as this such that this limit makes sense. And if this limit does exist, it is of course for large k just what we call normally the renormalized action. And of course, one would not just want that the limit here is finite, but also that at some scale, captures whatever physical engaged degrees of freedom one aims at. Later this week, I think there will be a talk on how to reconstruct their action, starting from a given truncation of the functional flow equation. I think this is exactly the kind of step one needs to do, but more work needs to be done on that issue, in my view. And the way how I think about it is as follows. So on the level of only this gamma k, I think it is very, very difficult to come up with a reasonable guess even for the answer of this last question. So which sequence of local or non-local truncations should be chosen such that the sequence converges in which sense to the unknown full answer? And I think just by staring at the gamma k, one will never be able to answer this. So my way of looking at this, what we should do is pick a sequence of gamma k truncations worked out by the techniques of the talk. The associated sequence of bare actions, and then choose the sequence of truncations in such a way that the associated sequence of bare actions has a reasonably nice limit. Whatever one in the context one is thinks the bare action should look like, and that will also answer that question. But in a sense, you can see, you just rediscovered the ultraviolet regularized functional integral that way.
But exactly what do you mean by a reasonable bare action? I suppose that it has infinite many terms.
No, as I said, whatever. So you need to make up in your mind. This also what I mean. The issue in itself is both physics-wise underdetermined and mathematically underdetermined. So at some point one needs to make up one's mind. What? Yeah.
But exactly what do you mean by making up one's mind?
No. Say, I mean, at some large scale, what kind of physical degrees of freedom do you want to be in that renormalized action? Mm. And that doesn't come out of the mathematics. Mm. So that would make a link, at least so to say, from a bird's eye point of view, between the ultraviolet regularized functional integral and this gamma k flow. And of course, it would be nice to work this out. And now, what is the link, or what is the role of perturbation theory in this context? So, offhand, of course, perturbation theory only produces a formal power series in the loop counting parameter h bar. But most people think if the theory contains dimensionless coupling, which is asymptotically free at one loop order, the rearranged perturbative series, rearranged such that it is now a series in powers of this asymptotically free coupling, does indeed describe the ultraviolet regime of the theory. It's correctly. And I think, by and large, the very same rationale also applies to asymptotically safe theories. So by this I mean theories where all the couplings stay bounded at all scales and have a finite, possibly non-zero limiting values. And the issue of whether or not the limiting value is zero or non-zero is really not that central, because one needs to keep in mind that the numerical value of the limit is at best indirectly related to the actual Gaussian or non-Gaussian nature of the fixed point. At least in my understanding, Gaussian fixed point is one where one can find a set of fields on the space of fields such that in this basis of fields, the functional measure in the vicinity of the fixed point looks Gaussian. But it may not at all be easy to find this set of fields. So strictly speaking, we don't even know whether the fixed points that have been found here are Gaussian or non-Gaussian, because in order to show that it's an actual non-Gaussian fixed point, one would have to show that no such special sort of basis in the space of fields can be found with respect to which the functional measure becomes Gaussian in the vicinity of the fixed point. So that's also why I have been using the terminology non-trivial versus trivial fixed point instead of non-Gaussian versus Gaussian. And going now back to the 1979 article, at least in my reading of this excerpt here, it seems to just call actually for use of a suitably adapted version of perturbation theory. So sum up what has been done is if one uses a suitably refined perturbative framework, one can actually study these non-trivial fixed point and asymptotic safety already in standard one-loop perturbation theory. A nice feature here, which I didn't yet have time into, is the following fact, namely in the very definition of the Euclidean functional integral, one makes use of a weak or anti-weak rotation, which was in fact also mentioned in Renata's talk. It's the same weak or anti-weak rotation here. And it turns out to sort of scope with features related to the conformal factor, this weak rotation should be done with respect to a fiducial De Witt metric of indefinite signature, and one can motivate this indefinite signature and De Witt metric actually simply from the classical theory. So one can look at that in detail. Say if one defines attractivity of gravity by a volume contraction, and one looks in a Hamiltonian formulation at modified theories where the signature of the De Witt metric is unspecified, then it gets volume contraction exactly when the signature of the De Witt metric is indefinite. So this fact reflecting indirectly, at least, the attractivity of classical gravity is used to define the Euclidean functional integral. And then, as this computation shows, the nice feature is that the classical attractivity of gravity seems to imply an anti-screening behavior, at least in this sense, of the quantum theory in the ultraviolet regime. In the features which one finds for this higher derivative gravity are especially nice. So the theory is perturbatively renormalizable to all loop orders. The PT expansion can be organized as one as being one in this unique asymptotic topping S. One should not regard it as a series in the dimension of the Scapa's problem. And then one finds non-trivial positive pH independent sticks points. And having worked myself for some time on the issue that one can trust the one loop running of dimensionless asymptotically free coupling beyond perturbation theory, I think the on the one loop level, being able to see these fixed points already on the one loop level in a perturbation theory in an asymptotically free coupling, in my view, this fixed point is now beyond reasonable doubt. I also mentioned that traditional positivity problems in higher derivative gravity simply do not show up. And the next step would be, as has also been mentioned in the last talk, so these running couplings, of course, are not really yet physical quantities. So in the next step, one should really try to relate this flow to an asymptotic expansion of physical quantities, which is, of course, the issue which was highlighted 30 years ago already. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the interesting talk. So we have a tight schedule, but we should have time for a few questions.
Does your perturbation theory break down when at low energy?
I would not want to make any statement about low scales, low energies. In fact, my, so to say, bird's eye view would be that one should use this kind of perturbation theory to pin down the high energy regime and then maybe match the beta functions or multi-point functions or whatever one wants to work out at some intermediate scale against what, and then use the functional renormalization flow to propagate this piece of information to lower scales.
Of course, this is also a problem in QCD.
Right.
I didn't fully understand why you feel so sure that if you do a two loop calculation, you will not destroy your fixed point structure.
Because it's a perturbative extension in an asymptotically free coupling. So the fixed point in S will always be, I mean, at the moment at least, I cannot see what could go wrong. So maybe one should look into that, but of course doing a two-loop computation is very hard. But at the moment, I simply don't see what could go wrong.
Okay. Can I
have the? Yeah, so I didn't understand the argument that the positivity problem is solved. Could you just write down the spin two, what is the spin two part of the renormalized graviton propagator look like?
Yes. So as we already discussed, that the spin 2 part is actually always gauge independent.
Okay, good. Mm-hmm.
And so in this standard basis, if you write down H inverse, P is P2, then here you will basically have the inverse of this lambda 1 and lambda 2. And it looks like that. So lambda 1 is P to the 4 plus, I think, S over kappa squared, P squared minus 2 lambda. And now, of course, I do not want to make any statement about genuine infrared issues. So let me always take P squared large and some fixed positive number epsilon. But then you can see for any epsilon, if you make mu large enough, that is S small enough, this will always be positive, as nice as you want.
Okay, why is it?
Because you now reorganize things in powers of S.
So the point is, in a sense, you've done perturbation theory with the vial squared as the leading
exactly,
term,
right.
And you're correcting by the mutants.
Right. And that's also why I wouldn't really want to make a statement whether this non-trivial fixed point is sort of Gaussian or non-Gaussian, because I don't really know. I mean, it's from the way how this...
So the question is, so you have a high energy behavior which is dominated by P, 1 over P to the 4th. You don't have a low energy behavior yet that you understand, so you don't know that you get Newton's gravity and in the limit of small p squared.
Well, that's so to say, in any one loop computation based, or where you design your perturbative series to one in a UV asymptotically free coupling. Of course, strictly speaking, not much can be said about the low energy regime, but this is exactly the same issue in QCD. So then you need...
So in some sense, I mean, the question is, so if the high energy propagator goes like 1 over P fourth and 1 over P fourth log P squared with the running of the coupling constant, so I think we agree about that. The low energy, when you get it right, should go like 1 over m squared p squared.
The question is, in the
interpolation between the high energy and the low energy, is there another pole? That's the question. And sorry,
what I'm saying is, in the regime where perturbation theory can reasonably be expected to work, there is no issue.
Okay.
Great. Thanks. That's all I can say. Yeah.
Yes, I have a comment and a question. I agree with you that the fixed point can be seen in more of a preservation theory, absolutely. And concerning the connection with the flow equation beta function, if you consider, if you know, one can consider a one loop approximation to the flow equation. And if you insert in this one-loop approximation, so the question, the action that you wrote with the terms up to y squared, then you get beta functions which are entirely consistent with the absolute.
I in fact looked at, no. They're not the same, but they have the same form. And indeed, what I would like to do with you guys later this week, maybe to look into the details. So why they don't literally match, why the form is the same, what needs to be done in order. And so my picture, I mentioned it. So whatever beta function or running coupling, one can work out by this one loop perturbation theory computation. I think it should give the reliable answer at large energy scales, if you like, scale. And then if you just naively use one rule fixed perturbation theory, you don't really know how to extend this, and you can work out two loop maybe, but it should be better. But then at some point, what one should do is to simply use whatever non-perturbative formalism is on the market. At the moment, it's mostly this functional renormalization flow, and then sort of match the beta functions here, and then simply look how they would extend to lower things.
Well, that was my comment. I wanted to make a question. I was a bit puzzled by some statements you made about page independence, because
yes.
I remember general arguments that I associate with the name of Kawai and Inomiya, but I think
there are lots. There are lots. Yeah.
That if you take the dimensionless product of G times lambda,
yes, yes.
Multiple
constant,
that should be
Bayesian
dependent.
Yes, which one can.
This seems to contrast with some of the things that you said. So.
No. It doesn't. So, in fact, I also worked out beta functions for this. It's normally called tau. Yeah? And so, one can also work out the beta function there. And indeed, what always so the statement is the beta function for this object is independent of the wave function renormalization constants if they enter at all, and it is also independent of the gauge fixing parameter if you start off with effective action that is gauge independent on shell in regularized form. But as I pointed out, this is simply usually not the case. What is gauge independent on shell are only the coefficients of the logarithmic divergences. But for G and lambda, you need the other terms too. And unless you do something very special, that will come out to be gauge dependent.
So I feel we have to move on. I was already warned by the staff members that we should stay to the schedule. So let's thank Max again. And I will break up 12.5 seconds. Welcome. Next.
Set the door right now. Black shirt and black.